The Art Dealer Diaries are brought to you by Medicine Man Gallery, located for over 26 years in Tucson, Arizona, specializing in antique Native American art, early Western art, including the famed Maynard Dixon, as well as modern art. You can find everything online at medicinemangallery.com. There's over 6,000 objects to select from. Also, the Charles Bloom Murder Mystery Series, written by yours truly, me, Mark Sublett.
There's 8 books in the series.
And they follow the protagonist Charles Bloom through all the intrigue of the art world set in Santa Fe and the Navajo Nation. These can be found on Audible, eBooks, Amazon, and of course, the gallery at medicinemangallery.com. This is part 2 of Kristen Atwell Ford's interview podcast. And I kind of go in the weeds with the second part, which is we discuss some of the films that she's done, including one that she did for the Salt River Project, which Peter Coyote was the narrator, and she ends up getting an Emmy. In fact, she has 2 Emmys for her work, and how that came about and the importance of that, as well as discussing some of the things that influence her and people that are really important in the field of documentary films, like Ken Burns, and you know, what's his role in making documentary films. So, I mean, this is a person who's donated her entire life to making documentary films and of subjects that maybe aren't normally the subject you might think of. And one of the ones that were, you know, really this came about was the one that she did with Ed Mel and the landscapes that he did for the opera, which was a new opera that never had been done before, which was Riders of the Purple Sage by Zane Grey. And this movie that she made of the making of the opera, and where Ed is also quite involved in this, is one of the things that we're really promoting, because her film is going to be running March 25th through Sunday, April 11th. And you can go to writersoperafilm.com, and for $10, you get to see the film, which is really interesting. In fact, I was there for part of the making, so I can tell you from a firsthand view that it was very interesting. And I've seen the film, and it's really amazing, quite frankly. And the $10 that you pay really goes to help the Actors Fund, and it's going to the Actors Fund, which helps all the people that are involved that are out of work and been struggling during the pandemic. So it's a give back, and I hope everyone goes to it. She was very interesting. I hope you enjoy the podcast as much as I enjoyed doing it.
Is there a film that's ever been done like this, that's documenting a new opera that's never been, you know, it's a brand new opera. They came up with it, and, you know, the use of an artist and how they, is there anything like that out there?
Let's say no.
Yeah.
I don't know. There are two other opera films that have just come out in the last few years. The Metropolitan Opera had a lovely film called The Opera House, which was about how the creation of Lincoln Center and the architectural design and how they ended up being where they are and what it meant to everyone to move out of the old Opera House. There's also a film about a year in the life of the Paris Opera. But I can guarantee you, in terms of, you know, Paris Opera and Met, those are two of the biggest in the world. For Arizona Opera, a regional opera house that's doing a new work, I think this is fairly unheard of. And, you know, it really energized the entire community around Arizona Opera. I'm not an opera person, you know, I have a music theater background and I love musical theater, but to me, opera was foreign and I didn't really relate to it. But here we have an opera that's based on a best-selling novel. It's the only Western on the Library of Congress's list of 100 books that shaped America. Mm-hmm. It was immediately translated into 20 languages and sold over 1 million copies in 1912. Mm-hmm. And it's really the story of Western settlement, Anglo settlement in the West. It's all in English. And, you know, Zane Grey did paint the Mormons as the bad guys, because you always need good guys and bad guys. But the fact is, you know, we wouldn't have been born in the arid landscape of the Southwest without the Mormons coming out and figuring out how to farm and irrigate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it is a fictional story. We do owe a lot to the Mormon settlers and pioneers who came out before us. And at the same time, what Zane Grey created was this kind of mythos of the West. And when you look at Ed Mell's work, Ed Mell's my favorite living painter. And I know that maybe I shouldn't say that to someone who carries so many jaw-dropping, gorgeous, contemporary fine art painters. But for me, the first time I stood in front of an Ed Mell painting, he gets the feeling of what it's like to be there.
Yeah, he's an Arizonian.
Yeah.
You know, born and raised Arizonian.
And he totally understands that. And so you have this story that's the settling of the West. And then you have, you know, our Arizona's visual poet laureate, if you will, who's interpreting the landscape of it. And then you have Craig Baumler, who's a local composer. He's, you know, originally from Texas, but he's been in the Southwest for a long time. He's interpreting the Southwest in the music. And all of these factors together, the opera energized our arts community, because art doesn't happen without business. It doesn't happen without patrons. It doesn't happen without an audience. It doesn't happen with collectors. And here we had a piece that had such a large tent. You know, we had, you know, Scottsdale's Museum of the West let us film over there. And we had all these people from the fine art world with Jennifer Sands and Christine Mulring inviting all of their friends into the opera house for the first time. Mm-hmm. And then you have all these people from music, theater and literature and people who love Westerns and have been diehard Zane Grey fans their whole life, who are suddenly sitting down to watch an opera. And we sat there in that theater and watched our story. You know, in Arizona, we owe so much to the culture of Native Americans and Mexican Americans. And this particular story is very much about the Anglo experience. And yet I feel when we honor the landscape, we honor all who come before us. And that's what I really want people to feel with this film and us unveiling this film, is to find their piece of it. And I guarantee, whether it's costuming or set design or how a singer works or how Ed Mell mixes his colors, there's something in there that appeals to people who love the arts.
Oh yeah, I agree. And it showed in Tucson, and the opera did too, and it was packed house every time as well.
Yeah, right before COVID.
I know.
Yeah, we had
some. The last thing I saw before, I think your film and that was the last thing I saw, and then that was it. Haven't been in a theater since.
Yep.
And we're, you know, we still have a ways to go, but there is we can see, you know, a window is coming quickly. So.
Yeah, I think the world's going to open back up slowly, and I think we'll all be more grateful to be able to be together and witness these collaborative art forms.
Yeah, I hope so. Well, one of the things we'll do for people who are listening and watching this on YouTube is we'll make sure we have links that you can get to the website. And so we'll not only have this link, but we can have some other links too, if you'd like maybe to your website as well and that kind of thing. So, and if
Fantastic.
You'll send me some pictures too, by the way, we'll put them inside the YouTube version of the one that we're doing right now. So we'll have some images.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. We've got lots of goodies.
Yeah. And I might even have some photos I took when I went down there. I'll have to go look. I'm sure I must, because I sat there and watched the whole process. It was very interesting when I was seeing that unfold in front of my eyes. I remember sitting in that theater going, wow, this is something exceptionally different. And I kind of absorbed it at that moment, going, this is a once in a lifetime type of thing, you know? and it's so great that it was all captured on film. You know, that you did this.
Well, I'm very fortunate, and that, you know, the film was really made possible by Billy Joe and Judd Herberger, who, their names are synonymous with the arts here in Arizona. And they had a personal connection. Not only do they love the arts, but Judd used to play at Zane Grey's cabin when he was a kid before it burned down in the Dude fire, I think is what took it. And so everybody found their piece of this. And what I really love about this film is when you go to the theater and you sit for an hour or two, and you see all of this work condensed. It's just like looking at a canvas, you know, all of those hours condensed into one image. This film really shows the months and the work and the detail that goes behind that live performance that's condensed into that magical moment of sitting in the theater.
And you had tons and tons of film or tape, whatever, right?
Don't remind me. Yeah. I might have overshot a little bit.
Well, but you had to cut it down. That has to be a hard process, actually, right? The editing is really where the movie, the magic happens, right?
It is. And we laid out a 2 or 3 hour cut of the film from, you know, hundreds of hours of footage, because at that time my fear was this show's only going up for its world premiere once. What if we miss it? And we laid it out, and it's very dense. You know, Craig Baumler, the composer, always says the simplest telling of a story is the best. And, you know, when you're weaving in over 100 years of arts in the Southwestern region into one story, it's just a lot of complexity, and it's very dense. So I looked up Jacob Bricka, who teaches in the film department down of U of A. And he said, you know, I'm busy, I'll give you some input. And I'm like, no, you need to save me, because somebody needs to come in from the outside who's looking at this fresh. And even Jacob Bricka, who's, you know, he and his wife have this amazing film called Missing in Brooks County, about illegal immigration, that's out right now. And he's worked long form documentary for years. Even he would call me and say, I'm exhausted after working on this for a day. It's just so complex. But we really were able to hone it down to the simplest telling of the story. And I hope that reads. The director of the opera, Fenlon Lam, when she first watched a rough cut, she said the film builds like an opera. Mm. And I thought, okay, well, that's a good thing. I didn't know I was doing that, but that's a really good thing.
Yeah, it does, actually. I mean, I could feel that building. I could feel that. It seemed like it was missing one part. I don't know. It was an art dealer part that could have been.
you're in good company on the cutting room floor, Mark. Let me just tell you that.
No, I understand. Well, quite frankly, I'm not part of the story, honestly. I mean, you know, it's and you have to get, like you say, get to the basics, the simplicity of the story. I mean, when I write my murder mysteries, sometimes I have to cut out parts that just don't move the story along. They may be great parts, and I really was proud that I wrote them, but if they don't advance the story sequentially and in a timely fashion, then you're doing a disservice to what you're producing.
I absolutely hear that. And that is the heartbreaking part. But, you know, now that we have the internet.
Yeah, that's right.
That's where those little pieces go. So, it does. I'm glad that you get the complexity. I think you do because of your personality. I think it's really rare for someone to, I mean, you were a physician, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now you're an art broker and an author, and you host a series, and you do all of these things, and you understand how multidimensional we can be. But that's really fascinating to me. I mean, after all of that training, what lured you away from practicing medicine?
I always say that, you know, medicine was my girlfriend and art was my wife. It was just more intense for me, you know, and I was able to recognize that at a young age. You know, I was like 32 or something like that, and realized now's the time to do it. If you're going to do it, you got to do it, you know, because life's short. You never know once, you know, it's going to, and if you get locked in, you're going to be, you know, that's your road. It's just like running that rapids, honestly, you know, and come to a fork, and, you know, you got to choose which one, you know, and it's going to swish you down all the way to the bottom. You know, and one way may be fine, and it'll be nice and even water, and it'll be maybe an enjoyable run, but it might not be as exciting. So I chose this one. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you did.
Yeah, it puts me here, right? I mean, I wouldn't be here in this capacity otherwise. I might have been a physician on stage helping the actors if they got injured or something like that, which I did. I did sports medicine. I remember working with ballerinas and things like that. So I did work with those individuals. So you What's the next project that you're working on right now? I know we talked a little bit, but can you share what you're, you know, what you're doing at this moment?
I can. Well, before we got Writers Out, we did a documentary film about Castle Hot Springs, the resort right. that my mom owned briefly in the 80s. And it has been completely brought back to life and renovated by Mike and Cindy Watts. And they have done a beautiful job. It's like, for me, it was like seeing my grandmother be brought back to life. It's just miraculous what they've done out there. And that film, Castle Hot Springs, Oasis of Time, is now streaming on Amazon Prime. So you can check that out if you have an interest.
Yeah.
And then we're very, very, very fortunate that we're already working on our next film about Liberty Wildlife, the Wildlife Rehabilitation right. Center in Phoenix. And a detail about Liberty that your community might be interested in is they are one of two legal sources for feathers for Native Americans to use in ceremony. Mm. So as you know, the Lacey Act and the Migratory Bird Act made it illegal for Native Americans or anyone, in fact, to own feathers or bird parts or
talons.
And that was very detrimental to Native American cultures. And so they have what's called the Non-Eagle Feather Repository at Liberty Wildlife. And people who have tribal membership can write in and for free get different species for use to make regalia and religious items that they need to stay connected to their spiritual life and their cultural identity.
And so they can be birds of prey, feathers, but not eagles.
The eagle, there is an eagle, gold, bald eagle and golden eagle repository that's regulated by U.S. Fish and Wildlife out of Denver, Colorado. And there's a great long waiting list to get eagle feathers.
Right.
But Liberty Wildlife out of Phoenix, Arizona, they have the non-eagle feather repository and they get donations of birds from other rehabilitation centers all around the country. And so if you need a snowy egret or you need a pelican or you need, you know, that's one of the reasons why we're making the film is to grow that program to let Native Americans know that there is a source for legal feathers that are free to them. And hopefully we'll take a dent out of the black market feather trade where birds are killed just for their feathers.
Yeah. It's interesting from a standpoint of selling artwork, you know, Native American artwork. If they use that for Native American artwork, you know, make a contemporary bond or whatever, as a dealer, we still couldn't deal in it. We couldn't handle it. Mm-hmm. You know? They might be able to sell it because of what they did, but as soon as it comes into my hands, even if I'm buying it from the artist, I'm now breaking the law if I go to sell it. Yeah, and you might find that to be an interesting component to look into for the documentary is, you know, what happens when they make this and it's all legal and what they're doing, but no one can deal in it. It would be a felony if I sold it, even though it's brand new, you know, even if it was a, you know, put on a kachina and I bought it and then sold it, you know. So I don't know if they've looked into that component of that. And the Native Americans probably don't, the artists may not know. I mean, they're doing everything right. They're doing it from a standpoint of, you know, good intention and following the rules and everything, and it's important to the art, but as soon as it hits the market, you know, after their hands, it's against the law.
Interesting.
Yeah. So one more component to add to your I'm sure already voluminous documentary on there is what happens afterwards. Yeah, you should ask, you know.
I will ask.
And they may not know. The artisans may not know, but as soon as it, you know, as soon as it leaves their hands, then it's a problem, depending on how they use it. Now, there should be ways that they could regulate that and actually say, you know, they, you know, put it in a documented piece, you know, and use blockchain technology is actually what they should, and say, this was made, this is the one, and it's all right and everything. But, you know, right now it would go against the state and federal laws.
Interesting. Well, you know, and I know that the feather repository at Liberty Wildlife is specifically for religious purposes. Mm. So it probably doesn't extend to providing feathers for artwork.
That would make sense. Yeah, that would make sense.
But art does keep the spirit alive. So I don't, you know, it might be a slippery slope.
Yeah. And what's artwork to religion and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, the religious part makes sense. Yeah, we can't handle anything like that ever, you know, if it comes in.
Well, and plus I thought we were going to make a documentary about how no one wants antiques anymore.
Is that what you thought you were going to do?
You said to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, that is. Yeah, we should. It's really, you're right. It, I mean, it's a very interesting component. I mean, today in the news, an NFT, a non-fungible token, piece of crypto artwork sold for $69 million at Christie's.
What?
Yes, exactly. So it's non-fungible tokens are just an image on your phone of something that's created on the computer. They're selling for huge amounts of money. And today, yesterday, it sold for $69 million, something that was developed on the computer and sold at Christie's. And this is a huge area of development and interest for, you know, lots of artists that are making them. So, you know, Jack Dorsey's first tweet, you know, sold for an image of it. One of one image of it sold for $2.5 million as well. So
I was under the impression that something that is replicable is of less value. I mean, that isn't that the one point
of photography? One would think that is correct, right? But you could get any of these things that are on the internet, you know, Michael Jordan slamming a dunk, or, you know, a piece of art that's made on the computer that's shared by millions and millions of people. But if it's documented in a blockchain technology as saying, this is the only original one, all the other ones out there, you can look at them, but you don't own it. You own the original image. That one's worth a ton of money. And I bring this up because if that's what's happening and that brings 69 million, where does antiques fall? Toast? I don't know. You know, I mean, if the new generation of artists, art collectors are interested in things that are digital and moments in time, even though they're out there by the billions, you know, but you'll pay to have that documented as your little moment, then, you know, is that the new world of art? So, you know, I do think that antiques are and that trade are changing rapidly. It's not going to ever be what it was. I mean, it's almost as if we're at the time frame when automobiles were coming in and the horses were going out, you know, and, you know, which is technology again. Right. So NFTs, which you should look into, because this is a big major thing that's going on. You know, is it a bubble? I don't know. 70 million says it probably isn't a bubble.
Interesting. And, you know, I still like to go to the museum and stand where the artist stood, you know, and think about what decisions she made to create the scene. And, you know, you feel that and to look at the brush strokes. And I don't know, I still read books. I don't write a Kindle. I like to hold things.
Well, your next time and some future component, there'll be little screens which you'll look at people's artwork that is on it and go, wow, somebody owns that image that he made on a computer generated.
Well, and I, you know, I'm one to talk being a filmmaker in the digital age, but you know, it's being human is an interesting ride, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we're not, who's to say if it's right or wrong? I mean, it's art. I mean, Duchamp and his urinal, you know, that's considered to be fantastic art. And in a lot of ways it really is, you know, very valuable, but at the time, and even today, people are like, what, you know? So yeah. Why don't you do the one on antiques? And that would be very interesting. Why the people are still around, the people that, you know, because that area is, and most of the antique dealers are still, not all, there are younger people, but they were pre-internet and they dealt in that way. And they're still, unfortunately for a lot of them, that's still how they think and deal. And so they haven't been able to go to the next level. And of course, you know, they're going to be done, you know, with their, you know, life and as far as what they do in the next 10 to 20 years tops. So one of the reasons I do this podcast is to try to get interested people that are younger going, well, this is an interesting field that I would like to do. And most of the people that are doing it are older and, or about to retire or are retired. And, you know, there's still, and I see that there are people that are coming into at least Native American and Western art and that kind of stuff, but antiques, I'm not so sure.
Well,
I'm happy to work with you on that one.
Right. I won't leave down the cutting room floor. There are a couple films that I want to get to in my life. And one, Harvey Leek is part of the Zane Grey West Society and who's been so helpful on the writer's film. And his great grandparents were Louisa Wetherall.
And his, John. John and Louisa Wetherall.
John and Louisa Wetherall, who were so influential in the Santa Fe arts movement from their vantage up on in Kyanto with the Trading Post, right. and they have their own collection of photos, which is
they knew Maynard Dixon.
Yeah, I mean
Harry Dixon did their marker for the graves, which is in Kyanto.
Yeah, I mean they're just and Harvey is just really cool, and it's just a treasure trove of the Colorado Plateau. And then I'm starting a project. I want to do a project about my mom. It's going to be the 60th anniversary of what she went through with.
I wondered about that, if that wouldn't be one that seems like a natural for you, right? I mean, that's passion is there, right? Yeah. I could see that. Another one I would think would be interesting. Of course, there's always a million, but going back to your main root one that you did when you were in 1991 or 92 and follow up with those same individuals to see that you documented their families and where they've come from there to now.
Wow, that would be cool too. I love that passage of time and, you know, seeing what forks people take, just like we were talking about with you and where you end up down the road.
Yeah, can you imagine? I mean, that's a long time.
It is a long time.
You might even have three you might have, well, you've changed as a person. And, you know, that's could be as many as three generations from there for first, second, and third to see where they went, you know, because migration and immigration and all that is such an important part of our fiber of what we're dealing with as a country right now, to see how those individuals who were documented in 1992, you know, 30 years later are, what are their kids doing and their grandkids and, you know, how is that assimilation or lack of assimilation? I have no idea, you know, and it might be hard to track people down, but it might be worth the effort.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting. You got good ideas, Mark.
Well, they come from you. It's not really the idea. I mean, they're your ideas. They're, you know, what you did and how you did it. So I could just see that one. But I think one of the problems with being a documentary filmmaker, and you can tell me if it's true or not, but there's so many ideas and there's so little time.
Yeah, it's each, I mean, I get to become an expert in each topic and it does take time and it takes a lot of resources. I mean, these are, we have more tools at our disposal now, you know, everybody can document everything right in their pocket. But really to get something out and to get it where people can be seen, it ain't cheap. So you really have to choose wisely but I'm the luckiest person in the world. I get to tell stories for a living. I mean, what could be better than that?
Yeah, that is amazing. I mean, you have, again, behind you, the two Emmys and the one, I read some of the Theodore Roosevelt Salt River Project. That was very interesting. If you don't mind just giving me 2 minutes on that, just because, I mean, you work with Peter Coyote, you got an Emmy, it's available on Cox. I mean, it's really an interesting project.
Well, Salt River Project wanted to document the construction of Roosevelt Dam for its centennial in 2011. And what's interesting about the timing of the dam is Arizona got statehood the year after Roosevelt Dam was built. And that reliable water supply was a large part of the federal government feeling like Arizona had an economic base that could sustain itself as a state. We owe a huge debt of gratitude. We were talking about Mormon farmers with Riders of the Purple Sage. A lot of the Mormon pioneers came in, and a lot of Anglo pioneers came in, and there was either too much or too little water in Phoenix. So you know, your crops would wither up, or it would flood and it would wash away all your work. And so there had just been a depression in the late 1890s, and the Hudson Bay Company tried to get the dam site going up at Tonto Creek and the Salt River at that junction, and they couldn't finance it. And finally, Salt River Project at that time was the Water Users Association. And each member, each farmer pledged their land, mortgaged their land to the federal government to raise the funds to build Roosevelt Dam. And in the 50s, I think there's a big check that SRP has that finally paid that debt back. But this is really an example of how a community builds itself. And it's the last major block and tackle dam that was ever built, because the next major, this was the start of the Reclamation Department, and there's a handful of projects, and the Salt River Project was one. And, within, 15, 20 years, you've got Hoover Dam going up, which was all concrete being poured on site. But they brought in Italian stonemasons. A lot of them were living up in the Globe, Miami area. And there are a lot of beautiful buildings up there that are hand carved, and they hewed these moved them with the big block and tackle. There wasn't even a railhead at the dam site. I mean, they brought in a lot of the Apache people who had been pushed back into the reservations. And the word was that the Apache and Yavapai really, really enjoyed working at the dam site. They were working on the road to bring the supplies up from Phoenix, the Apache Trail. They enjoyed being there because they could live in their wikiups and in their more traditional family orientations, so off the res. So it's a really interesting story of this kind of classic frontier town. And I've always wanted to make a narrative Western out of it, because what better plot line do you have than all of these people moving in and all the things that happen in the town? And, Chinese people aren't allowed to work on the government project, but they become cooks and gardeners. And you have the doctor's wife who's teaching the children, and you have these Italian stonemasons, and just this, all of these different people, and the Native Americans and the foreman. And then as they accomplish their goal, the water rises and it covers the town, and the town's gone.
Yeah.
And it's just a really neat, I like really expensive stories. And but Roosevelt Dam, it's a great story. There was a lot of things to overcome. And my favorite moment in the movie is when they've got the dam about halfway built and the Salt River just comes and it tears it all down. And I always laugh at that point, because that's the river of my birth. That's the mighty Salt River doing its thing.
And they can find that on Cox, right?
Check out SRP Connect. It aired on Cox, and that's how we won the Emmy, Rocky Mountain Region Emmy for Best Historical Documentary. It might be on SRP Connect. I might be able to hook you up with a link.
Yeah.
They don't have it out there, but
Yeah. Well, and it's happening before we're a state, 1911, right? That's when this is going on.
They started preparing the dam site, I believe, in 1902 or 3. So it took them as long to build Roosevelt Dam as it did for me to make the Riders of the Purple Sage film, actually. But the government did send out Walter Lubkin, a photographer, and he documented, and he would go back to the same spot and take glass plate photos.
Wow.
Of the dam going up, and we are actually able to build a little animation of the dam going up from his work. It's beautifully documented. A lot of really, really fantastic elements we had to work with.
That's interesting. Yeah, that was, Arizona was a rough time in 1902.
Oh, it was a party. Definitely, like, you did not mess around. Bob Bozbel says in the Castle Hot Springs film, he said, you know, Arizona was hard to get here. You had to want to be here.
Yeah.
And right. You better have some skills if you were going to survive.
Yeah, he's right. 100%. Some way still is.
Once in a while.
Yep. And one last thing before we go, but I'd like to talk a little bit about Ken Burns. Just in the sense that he's such an important, or he seems to be at least a very important person who has brought documentaries to life. And now he's got this huge, you know, conglomerate of, you know, dozens of projects working at one time. Is his, the way that he makes his films, does it affect you in any form or fashion, even from just a cinematography fashion, and the way he's done it on a mass production level? I mean, because you could conceivably say, okay, let me set up a production company like that and get three or four projects going all at once, not just one.
Yeah, that's that's a level of executive function that I haven't figured out yet. But Ken Burns, I think, has been influential not only to documentary filmmakers, but how we view and read documentaries. His, I believe, that technique of moving on a photo and then adding the audio, especially to recreate a historic scene, is something that revolutionized the way that we use historical elements, but also the way they come alive in our minds when we watch these things. And so I think, you know, he was a game changer in that way as an artist. The fact that he focuses on American subjects and found, you know, jazz and baseball and the Civil War and national parks and Vietnam. And these are big subjects that are worthy
music.
Of country music. And he's really popularized the form, maybe in a little bit in the same way that Zane Grey did with Western novels, in that making our appetite for deep dive into, you know, looking at people like the Roosevelts and, you know, multi-limited series of hours and hours of footage and detail, and really coming away with a functional understanding of his subjects. Yeah, we all owe Ken Burns a tremendous debt of gratitude for his vision and his work.
And when he does that and takes on all these different projects, does that limit you somewhat though? Because you go, ah, Ken's working on this, or ah, Ken's working on that.
Oh yeah, I'm like, I'm calling up. I'm like, Ken, what are you working on? Because, yeah, you know, I don't want to compete. I will say that I believe I might have used Peter Coyote in my first film before Ken Burns.
There you go.
So maybe a little feather in my cap if I were able to have a feather. He's doing a series on Hemingway right now, and I think that's great. Who knows, maybe he would find Zane Grey. I would love to do a film about the way that Zane Grey has influenced the 20th century Western and the way the image of the Western has influenced our perception of the West.
Yeah.
Because Zane Grey influenced, I mean, you look at Quentin Tarantino had a masked writer, which is a character from Riders of the Purple Sage in Django. I mean, Kevin Costner, Tommy Lee Jones, all of these filmmakers, Ed Harris and his wife, Amy Madigan, they did the last film version of Riders of the Purple Sage in 1996. And the story morphed every time to kind of reflect the age. They were much more equal partners as Jane and Lasseter than the earlier iterations of the Riders of the Purple Sage films. And so, yeah, would I love to do that my vision of a Zane Grey film? Absolutely. Is Ken Burns going to get there first? Probably. Maybe. I don't know. Does it matter? You know, I had my favorite professor at Stevens College, Dr. Dillingham, said it doesn't matter if someone else has written about it. They won't write about it the way you will.
He is right about that. That is correct.
You know? So, I mean, should Ed Mel have not painted a series of flat base clouds because Maynard Dixon had already painted Cloud World?
Right. Well, yeah, That would have been a shame if he didn't.
Yeah, it would be a shame.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, it's, you know, when I look at Ed's work, I only see Ed's, you know, and he's such an original. And then I think most of the people that are younger artists and look to Ed, they don't see anything else, and they shouldn't. They see Ed's, you know. Ed might have taken the blocks and go, I see it, but when you put it in the blender and it comes out, it's not the same. You know, Maynard Dixon never turned his paintings on the side to paint them, I can assure you. And
I love that about watching Ed, and the way he works from the smaller studies, and how the painting evolves as it gets bigger. But that is something about Ed, and I think you said this in your interview, you always know when you're looking at an Ed Bell painting.
Yeah.
And his use of color, the way he mixes realism and modernism, and then the emotion of the painting, it's unmistakable. I mean, thank God for Ed Mel finding his voice and taking that turn and coming back to teach on the Hopi Res in the 70s and leaving the New York art scene behind so that he could find his voice. I've just got nothing but respect and awe for Ed. It's like, he's like the Beatles to me.
Yeah, well, my son said to me, he goes, so Dad, and you know, and he's, you know, almost 30 now, he goes, why isn't there an Ed Mel Museum? Because, you know, why isn't there, right? I mean, he goes from, you know, representational to modern. He's iconic in the imagery of Phoenix, and you know, why isn't there one? And I didn't have an answer to that. I said, well, yeah, you're right, I guess maybe there should be. So he'll laugh it off. Ed would laugh it off. I'll ask him that when I interview him, but you know, I'm just going to put it out there.
Well, someday we'll all go visit the little grocery store as a shrine.
Yeah, I mean, that could be part of the Ed Mel Museum. For those who don't know what we're talking about, it's studio. He's got this great studio that he's always worked out of. Anything you would like to share with the audience before we call it a day here?
Mark Sublette, I'm just so grateful to get to talk to you and be part of your world. And I really hope that people who love Western art in the West will come visit us and see Writers of the Purple Sage, The Making of a Western Opera.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to put it out there for the world. We appreciate it. And everything will be on our website. It'll actually not only be on the Art Dealer Diaries, but I'm going to put it on the Medicine Man Gallery site for those who want to see it, and they can click on. I highly encourage them to donate. It's not much, and we need the help for all these people that are in the arts, you know, that are struggling. So thank you so much. And let me know when we're ready to do the documentary on the antique trade.
I will do that.
I'm all in. I think it's a real thing.
It takes all in.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Have a good one. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye.